As Europe hurtled towards the apocalyptic confrontation that was the Great War, the situation for Christians under Ottoman rule continued to deteriorate. The Christians of the Middle East, from Palestine to Syria, Mesopotamia and Assyria, remained divided by denomination, a fact that was integral to the Ottoman system of administration for the dhimmis, the millet, or nation. In this way, the Ottomans could prosecute a policy of divide and rule, while foreign sympathy towards Christians was inconsistent, contingent on whether those Christians were Orthodox, Catholic, Oriental, or Nestorian. We have seen already that Catholic Christians in the Levant were faring better, owing to the protection of France and the economic investment pouring in from the West. Eastern Orthodoxy, once a core constituency for Ottoman rule, the Millet of Rum, the source of the Greek-Ottoman elite, the Phanariotes, and an endless supply of slaves, was transforming into an existential threat to the Ottomans. Throughout the 19th century, Orthodox Christians throughout the empire, from the Greeks in Hellas and Pontus, the Serbs, Bulgarians, etc., had revolted and gained independence in former Ottoman provinces, invariably with the support of Russia. The Ottoman response was typically heavy-handed and bloody, which ironically elicited considerable sympathy from the West to the plight of Christians, precipitating Western intervention on their behalf. Such was the case in 1827 and 1877. In the latter war with Russia, Armenian-majority provinces were sundered from the Ottoman Empire in their Anatolian heartlands. Were it not for the pro-Ottoman intervention of the British, the Ottomans may have lost both Europe and Armenia in the 1870s and 80s. Thus, when the Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II committed his self-coup in 1878, it was off the back of a growing and appreciable sense of antipathy and paranoia directed towards both the West and the Ottomans' own Christian populations. The Christians, who were perceived as increasingly alien, client groups of foreign powers, a fear compounded by the presence and activity of Western Christian missionaries. Abdulhamid II turned the Ottomans inwards towards Turkish nationalism and pan-Islamicism. But the tale of the Greeks and the Armenians is not the subject of this video. Their story has been covered extensively elsewhere on this channel. Indeed, what is noteworthy about both the Greeks and the Armenians is that they, at one time, had occupied pride of place in the upper echelons of the Ottoman hierarchy. Ethnic Greeks were the first among the Eastern Orthodox populations, as the Armenians were the first among the Oriental Orthodox. From the Ottoman perspective, their response to these constituencies was that of a perceived ethnic betrayal. For the Christians, it was a dramatic and tragic fall from grace. I openly wonder whether the Greeks and the Armenians would have fared better as privileged vassals under the Ottomans rather than national enemies, a situation which persists to this day. Whether or not such speculation is warranted, the tragedy of the Christian Aramaeans, by contrast, is that their persecution was a consistent feature throughout the history of Islamic dominance. Even now they remain stateless. My aim here is to tell their history and their path to martyrdom, the Sipho, to be put to the sword in the Neo-Aramaic language. The subtitle I've used here, The Assyrian Genocide, I've opted for the sake of audience recognition, though I'm loathed to use it. Why? The term Assyrian genocide is a modern, post-hoc and somewhat misleading descriptor. Assyrian nationalism is a relatively recent and contested phenomenon. Assyria conjures up the distant impressions of the Assyrian Empire of the ancient world, one of the world's first empires. The aspirations of modern Assyrian nationhood represents a total inversion of the dominion that the Assyrian Empire once held over the Middle East. Nevertheless, there are aspects of continuity between the two. They occupied the same core of ancient Assyria in the heart of modern Kurdistan, which is itself split between Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. They speak a derivative of ancient Aramaic, the lingua franca of the Middle East, of antiquity, corresponding to the borders of the Neo-Assyrian Empire of the 7th century BC. Aramaic that was influenced by the Assyrian-Akkadian language. What really distinguishes modern Assyrians from their neighbours is their steadfast devotion to Christianity. As an Aramaic-speaking people with a Syriac liturgy, they can trace an identity back to the early days of Christianity. The diaspora thus identifies as Arameans and Syrians as well as Assyrians. The points of demarcation are their Christian denominations. Christians who follow the West Syriac Christian liturgy, both Catholic and Oriental Orthodox, are more likely to identify as Syriac. Chaldean is a broad description, which has been typically applied to many Assyrian Catholics. The Nestorians of the Old Church of the East are most intimately associated with modern Assyrian nationalism, as is reflected in the 1976 rebranding of the Church of the East as the Assyrian Church of the East. Religious division, in my view, at once conflicts with modern Assyrianism, and yet it typifies it. For two millennia, Aramaic speakers have been divided by denomination, to the point that division had become their defining historical feature, not a bug. Far more so than the Catholic-Protestant division in Germany. Yet there is a far earthlier reason behind the advocacy of Assyrianism. To be Assyrian is to claim Assyria as a homeland, to define the borders of a nation, and to claim that nation as a supreme reality that has existed for millennia. It is a claim to legitimacy vis-à-vis their neighbours, and it is a compelling claim. Especially when one considers the preposterous Anatolian nationalism of Kemalism in Turkey, which attempts to establish an unbroken link between the Turks and the Hittites to justify the Turks as a first people, and the Armenians, Aramaeans, and Assyrians as subsequent interlopers. Genocide is a secular concept, the erasure of a people, in this case the Assyrian people. With everything that has been said, I am not content to view these events through the secular lens of genocide, for to me, martyrdom, to die for one's faith, is as, if not a more apt descriptor. With all the complexity and implications of these terms, I find there to be something elegant and yet horrifying in the simplicity of the Neo-Aramaic appellation of the Sipho to be put to the sword. I ended the discussion of the Assyrians in part 1 with the Schism of 1552. What is so significant about this event that divided the Church of the East between those in communion with Rome and those who were not? As I've already mentioned, the Ottomans structured their administration of conquered peoples around religious denominations through the allegiance afforded by Christian patriarchs. The implication of this went beyond religion, wherein a patriarch represented both a denomination and a nation within the Ottoman Empire. To be a patriarch and an ethnarch, head of an ethnos, or people. The ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, for example, was the head of the Roman nation, or Rum, within the empire. In the absence of a king, let alone an independent kingdom, the only realistic option for Assyria was autonomy, under a religious ethnarch subject to the Ottomans, or perhaps the Safavid Shia Persians. The Assyrian patriarchs of Alkosh came closest to this. For 100 years, the Elia dynasty established a system of hereditary succession to the patriarchate, mimicking the practice of royalty. The missionary efforts of Franciscan Catholics and the religious and political frustration directed towards the Elia line culminated in the defection of the Mosul-based priest, John Sulocca, who received the title of Catholic Patriarch of Babylon from Pope Julius III. Consequently, the Church of the East never consolidated sufficiently to establish an Assyrian nation within the Ottoman Empire. For centuries, the ever-diminishing refuge of the Assyrian people was confined to a region effectively stateless. Tamerlane had driven the majority of Nestorian Christians from Baghdad and the ancient Assyrian heartlands around Mosul into the mountainous Hakkari province of modern-day Turkey. Divided by denomination, the Assyrians were further divided into tribes, the Jilu, Dez, Baz, Tukuma, Tal, and Tiari, each in control of a cluster of villages. The Orthodox Assyrians clustered further west in the modern provinces of Diyarbakir and Mardin. Seldom did the Assyrians form the majority in any larger settlements. A tenuous balance existed between the Assyrians and the more recent Kurdish arrivals. Low-intensity conflict simmered on for centuries, characterized by localized attacks on trade caravans, cattle rustling, kidnapping, rape, pillage, and looting. Looting including that of Assyrian monasteries, which were invariably political as well as religious centers, fortresses, and libraries home to Syriac manuscripts and other antiquities. However, tribal divisions precipitated intra-ethnic conflicts, wherein Assyrians allied with Kurds and fought other Assyrians. To make matters worse, following the Battle of Chaldiran, Assyria became the border region between the Ottoman and Persian empires. Under the kings Shah Abbas and Nader Shah, the Persians led major expeditions into Ottoman territory, intensifying regional conflict and anarchy. Anarchy, however, did have its uses. The smaller Assyrian enclaves were self-governing, avoided Ottoman taxes, the jizya, and the worst aspects of the devashirme, the enslavement of Christian boys. Where the covenant of Umar did exist between Muslims and Christians, protection, applying that word very liberally, was afforded by the local Kurdish emirs. In the 1830s, Ottoman rule in the Middle East seemed on the brink of collapse, as the Albanian Pasha of Egypt, Muhammad Ali, conquered Syria, and even threatened Constantinople itself. Local Kurdish emirs and foreign powers smelled blood. The British in particular were concerned by the Franco-Egyptian alliance and took active steps to counter would-be areas of French influence in Mesopotamia and the Levant. The British sent a delegation, under a native Assyrian, Hormuzd Rassam, to woo the Assyrian tribes into accepting the protection of the British. This coincided with a flurry of British-American missionary activity. However, contrary to elevating the prestige of the Assyrians, their hospitality to the British had made them a target for Kurdish reprisals. In what began as a succession struggle, the Kurdish emirs Badr Khan and Nurallah formed an alliance with Ibrahim Pasha, son of Muhammad Ali, to cement their rule over the Ottomans' eastern provinces. The Nestorian patriarch, Shimun XVII, made the mistake of allying the Assyrians with a rival Kurdish emir, which made the Assyrians the singular object of Badr Khan's wrath. From 1843-6, 10,000 Assyrians were killed, many more were enslaved, and even the patriarch's mother was murdered and quartered. Though the Assyrians were weaker than ever, the Kurds' victory was fleeting. The Ali Pashas were driven out of Syria, and the Ottomans put an end to the rule of the Kurdish emirs. This pattern of atrocities, foreign intrigue, and the ensuing paranoia of the Ottoman government in Constantinople would only intensify. In 1877, the Ottomans and Russia went to war. In the 1860s, the Russians had committed genocide against the Circassians in the Northern Caucasus, an extreme response to British overtures during the Crimean War to the Circassians, and something eerily similar to the situation in Assyria 30 years before. The remnant of the Circassian population sought the protection of the Turks. In 1878, the Russians annexed the Turkish region of Kars, exacerbating fears that the Russians were instigating Armenian nationalists to serve as fifth columnists in a future conflict. The Russo-Turkish enmity recontextualized the relationship between the ruling and the ruled populations of these respective empires. The marginalized Assyrians and Armenians, potential allies of Russia, and the Azeris, potential allies of the Turks. With the self-coup of Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II, the empire reversed a general trend to constitutional reform, Tanzimat, along western lines, and bolstered the Sultan's role as autocrat and caliph, the natural protector of Muslims in the empire and beyond. Within this bolstered Islamic conception of rulership, Suspected treason served as a pretext to abandon the protections of the Covenant of Umar and seek vengeance on the Christians in the name of rectitude. During the 1880s, Kurdish raids against Assyrians and Armenians continued. This was, of course, a feature of life in the Ottoman East. But now Arabs and Circassians joined the Kurds, and by the 1890s, the raids were increasing in their ferocity. Indeed, rather than punish the Kurds, as had been the case in the 1840s, Hamid sanctioned the raids, casting the Kurds as his Hamidian regiments. By 1894, the raids had intensified into a series of deliberately perpetrated massacres, the Hamidian massacres. Though the Armenians bore the brunt of the onslaught, the attacks were fundamentally anti-Christian in character. Indeed, the massacres can be seen as the final dissolution of the Armenian millet, of which many Assyrians were a part. The vulnerability of the Assyrians was thus a direct consequence of the Armenians' dramatic fall, a shattering of the shield that had once protected them in theory. In addition to over 100,000 Armenian dead, 25,000 Assyrians were killed, and the knock-on effect was an empire-wide Christian exodus. Though the Christians in Syria and Lebanon fared better than their Eastern counterparts, hundreds of thousands of them decided to emigrate for Europe and America. The last hope for the Assyrians came with the deposition of Abdulhamid II, and the possibility of reform that would favour the Christians. Nevertheless, Kurdish attacks continued on regardless, and after 1913, the coup of the three pashas, and of Enver Pasha in particular, the Ottomans adopted an aggressive pan-Turkic policy. The sudden loss of most of the Ottoman territory in Europe led to a policy of resettlement, the resettlement of Turks and Muslims from the Balkans to the Ottoman border with Russia, while the local populations were displaced. Thus, the policy of Turkification at the expense of the Assyrians and the Armenians began prior to World War I. When the Ottomans ordered general mobilisation in 1914, the Assyrians were placed in an impossible situation. The Nestorian patriarch Shimon XIX implored the Assyrians to fulfil their duty as Ottoman subjects. Orthodox Assyrians near Diyarbakir and Mardin generally acquiesced to conscription, while the Nestorians in Hakkari resisted. The resistance to conscription in Hakkari is generally considered to be the beginning of the cipher. At first, Assyrians fled to Iran, which provoked a direct response by Talat Pasha, the Ottoman Interior Minister, and one of the three ruling pashas. An order was given to the governor of the Van Vilayet, the Vilayet encompassing Hakkari, to forcibly move the border Assyrians west in anticipation of an Assyrian insurrection. The insurrection never materialised, and the government lacked the efficiency to carry out the order. Instead, the situation devolved into random violence and killings by irregular forces. When the Russians advanced into the Van Vilayet and promptly retreated, the Christians of the occupied towns were treated by the Ottomans as Russian collaborators. Until now, the Turkification policies of the three pashas had been at odds with the non-Turkic, though Muslim, Kurds. Understanding that the Kurds were also being driven into the arms of the Russians, the pashas reversed this policy, appealing to the pan-Islamic legacy of the Hamidian regiments. Indeed, in November of 1914, the Ottoman Caliph formally proclaimed a jihad, a Muslim religious war. Kurdish enmity was thus redirected towards the Assyrians at the behest of the Turks once more. When Kurdish irregulars attempted to cut the bulk of the Assyrian tribes off from the Patriarch's capital at Kudshanis, the tribes mobilised for war with the Turks. An Ottoman offer of Assyrian autonomy in return for service was rejected as insincere given the circumstances. Shimon then entered into negotiations with the Russians. Beyond coordinating with the Russians in the defence of the Armenian population of Van, the Russians could offer no major support. As of May of 1915, the Assyrians were prepared to face off a planned encirclement by the Mosul governor, Haider Bey. The Assyrians had the advantage of terrain and successfully faced off many Ottomans, incurring unsustainable losses. The Ottomans had the decisive advantage of guns, machine guns, artillery, and manpower, and progressively forced the Assyrians to retreat further into the mountains as their villages were laid waste. After the summer campaign of 1915, the Ottomans had destroyed the Assyrian sources of food. Continued large-scale resistance was impossible. Many abandoned Hakkari to enlist with the Russian army. During the campaign, the Ottomans had captured the brother of the patriarch Shimon, Hormuz, in Constantinople, and used him to leverage the surrender of the Nestorians. In response, Shimon declared, "It is impossible for me and my people to surrender after seeing the atrocities done to my Assyrian people by your government. Therefore, my brother is one. My people are many. I would rather lose my brother, but not my nation." The Ottomans dutifully executed Hormuz. Shimon himself remained in exile in Iran until he and his entourage were murdered by Simko Shikak, a Kurdish nationalist. The massacre of Christian civilians coincided with this call to jihad. The violence spilled over into Iran, where around Lake Omiya lived some 30,000 Christians. The Turks had hoped to enlist the aid of more Sunni Kurdish irregulars through there in Shia Iran, though Shia Iran was officially neutral. The Christian refugees in Iran received Russian support and weapons, but without an immediate Russian military intervention, 20,000 Christians fled when the Turks invaded Iran, despite the attempts by one Christian, Aga Petros, to resist the invasion. When the Russian counterattack finally came, the Turks looted Christian villages during the retreat. Pillaging was justified as a military necessity for requisitions. Further west, the mobilization of the Assyrians under the Nestorian Patriarch and the fear of future defections to Russia precipitated reprisals against the Chaldean Catholics and the Orthodox Assyrians in the Christian Diocese of Sirte. Priests and the Catholic bishop there, Adai Sher, were arrested and later killed. This pattern of rounding up and killing the Christian clergy was repeated on a larger scale at Diyarbakir. There, the governor, Mehmet Reshid, broadened a government policy directed towards the Armenians to encompass an attack on all Christians of every race and denomination. Syriac Christians saw hundreds of their villages razed to the ground between Diyarbakir and Mardin. The most brutal instances of the massacres were of Tel Emran and Eskor. Those who weren't killed were deported or arrested and forced into labour battalions. Many Christians, however, resisted, coalescing into the Midyat rebellion in the hilly region of the Tur Abdin in the Mardin province. Here the Assyrians successfully repelled the Turks and Kurds at Iwado under the forces of Galo Sharbo and at Azak under Inagabri. The prospect of the Armenian genocide expanding into a generalized Sipho directed at all Christians had disturbing implications for Turkey's allies in the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria. The unexpected Assyrian victory at Azak caused the Germans to lobby for a general ceasefire. On Christmas Day 1915, the policy of deportation was rescinded and the Christians were permitted to stay. Tur Abdin became a rare instance of triumph in the overall context of the Sipho. Despite the Christmas truce, the damage had already been done. The Assyrian heartlands in Hakkari were destroyed. Overall, some 250,000 Assyrians, whether Chaldean, Orthodox or Nestorian, had been killed, roughly half of their population. The Assyrian Sipho occurred concurrently with the Armenian genocide, wherein at least 1 million were killed, and the genocide directed against the Greeks and Greek Orthodox, with casualty figures ranging as high as 750,000. Perhaps the Germans, all too willing to goad the Ottomans into jihad in the wild hopes of precipitating a general Muslim insurrection in the British Empire, had only considered the effect on Middle Eastern Christendom after it was already too late. I cannot leave this conversation without mention of the Kafno, the great starvation of the Maronites in Lebanon. It is difficult to situate the Kafno within the same narrative as the Armenian Genocide and the Sipho, though the results were the same, the mass deaths of Christians. In Lebanon, the Kafno led to the death of 200,000 people of a population of 400,000, more so than the German alliance with the Ottoman jihadis and the clumsy British overtures that helped cause the Assyrian massacres in the 1840s, the disaster here can be largely attributed to the Entente naval blockade in the Mediterranean. The French had invested heavily in Lebanon and Syria, and in Beirut in particular. The local economy in the Beirut Vilayet was geared towards international exports, while the legacy of the French military intervention in the 1860s had afforded the Maronites a high degree of autonomy relative to the other minorities of the Ottoman Empire. Both the economy and autonomy of Lebanon were dependent on the grace of foreign European powers, European powers that were now hostile to the Ottomans. With no food coming in from Europe, and the failure of various American-led humanitarian efforts, the Maronites were now totally dependent on the local Ottoman economy for food. Rather than feed a remote mountainous region inhabited by Christians suspected of potential treason, the Ottomans had a simple yet horrific solution: stop the food supply. Under wartime conditions, the commandeering of civilian trains and the requisitioning of food for the army now facing off against the British at Suez, was deemed a priority over the needs of the civilian population. But beyond this, military commanders on the ground consistently forbade the import of foodstuffs in the Lebanon. In other words, the Ottomans exploited the Entente blockade to subdue the Christian population through starvation, whereas the Assyrians were subdued by the sword. Kafno and Sipho, different strategies with the same effect. At the Paris peace conferences, Assyrians and Chaldeans attended, but were unable to present themselves as a large official delegation. An ambitious proposal was submitted to establish an Assyrian-Chaldean nation-state, whose projected territories were eerily similar to the territory claimed by the Kurdish nationalists. The principal argument presented was that the Assyrian Christians could not live under a Muslim government, either Kurdish or Turkish. The Sykes-Picot Agreement had already assigned Ottoman Syria and Iraq as mandates of France and Britain, respectively. The Treaty of Sèvres awarded Armenia a significant expanded territory with access to the sea. Of the remaining Ottoman territory east of the Euphrates River, an autonomous Kurdistan was created. The Assyrians were uniquely snubbed, even by the terms of the more lenient Sèvres, as they were placed within a Kurdish autonomous zone with clauses in the treaty to guarantee their protection. Lebanon, by contrast, was placed under direct French protection as a mandate. Even Greece was awarded an Anatolian enclave around Smyrna. Many Assyrians, who had survived in Hakkari and Mardin, made their way to the British Mandate of Iraq, which included Mosul, and with it Nineveh and other ancient Assyrian cities. On their journey, they were continually harassed by Kurdish irregulars who continued their own struggle for independence. Following the Russian Revolution, many Assyrians attempted to return to their homes in Hakkari province. They were led by Aga Petros, the man who had led the Christian resistance around Lake Urmia in Iran. Under Mustafa Kemal, the Turks had created a national republic and had effectively nullified the stipulations of the more harsh Sèvres by military fiat. The new Treaty of Lausanne established an enlarged territory with no prospect of an independent Kurdistan, let alone an independent Assyria. Agapetros' expedition met with failure. Kurds came to predominate in the depopulated Christian regions, and many of the Assyrian women left became Islamicized. Here I'm reading from an article written by Nowruz Atto, What Could Not Be Written, a study of the oral transmission of the Sipho. In the post-genocide period, in its attempt to deny it, the Turkish state was successful in silencing any high culture and written text in relation to the genocide. Indeed, master narratives were circulated in Turkish society in order to spread its own propaganda among its citizens. It has been argued that the Kemalist dictatorship continued the Committee of Union and Progress policy of suppressing all information on the 1915 genocide, including preventing books about the genocide published outside Turkey from entering the country. The Union and Progress Party was the party of Talat Pasha. In the first decades of the Turkish Republic, Turkish ruling elites had already developed a policy to ban non-Turkish music in Diyarbakir, the eastern province of Turkey. Patriotic songs and poetry were among the most important activities which intellectuals and political leaders of different ethnic groups accommodated the romantic idea of national awakening in pre- and post-genocide period, and therefore these activities also became subject to restrictive policies. The top-down imposed silence was also required from the victim groups. Public silence among the Assyrians regarding the genocide arose in the aftermath of the 1922-1923 Lausanne Conference, where a new peace treaty between Turkey and the Allied forces was negotiated, resulting in the treaty. Although its minority clauses included specific rights for non-Muslim minorities, Assyrians were later excluded following an insertion of a clause in 1931 that narrowed the definition of non-Muslim minorities to Armenians, Greeks, and Jews only, and thus denying Assyrians any access to these rights already tentative. Struggling to obtain a political foothold in the aftermath of the First World War, Assyrians negotiated the position and rights. At the 1919 peace conference, the Assyrians presented several petitions. In one case, Patriarch Elias III had deputized his successor, the Archbishop Bazaram, to represent the Syriac Orthodox Church and petition the following: that our ancient Assyrian nation had suffered proportionately more than any other nation, regrets that Assyrians have been neglected by the European press and diplomatic correspondence, in which all the Turkish massacres are called the Armenian massacres, while by right they should have been called the Christian massacres. Asked for the emancipation, the independence of the Vilayet of Diyarbakir, Bitlis, Kharput and Urfa from the Turkish yoke. Protested against the establishment of Kurdish authority. Asked for indemnities in compensation of the damages and asked for assurances of our national and religious future. Archbishop Bazaram ended this petition with, "We count on the justice of the peace conference to listen to our nation with sighs for a tolerable future in which she can play her ancient role of a Syrio-Chaldean civilization." However, the requests of the Archbishop were ignored. Reflecting on the process of the negotiations at the Paris peace conference years later, he expressed his despair at the way Western powers had dealt with the plight of his people. "There I laid bare all the catastrophes which had befallen my people. I spared no detail in describing the suppression and the horror, even though I particularly emphasized how our casualties had been both massacred in cold blood and had perished from hunger and cold during the war, when I saw that not one of the conference participants shed a tear or felt any compassion for us. I felt as if I had delivered my speech to statues carved from stone." The above clearly shows that the international community had already abandoned the Assyrians soon after the First World War. In this state of despair, Assyrians living in Turkey had to carry on with their lives as survivors of a catastrophe. The church remained the only institution of Assyrians, yet even that was left with terrified and traumatized leaders in charge of managing the remaining flock. What is especially significant about the loyalty discourse of the church leadership is that it led to the silencing of everything that could be deemed dangerous to the survival of the remaining community, so as to avoid any confrontation with the new Turkish rulers. I argue that it was because of such fear of Turkish repercussions that the church leadership directed their community to focus on basic religious practices rather than ethno-national rights, including remaining silent in public about their genocide. For example, Patriarch Elias tried to convince the remaining community in Urfa, "We have to safeguard the lives of the living because the dead are not coming back to life." According to Shakir, the Patriarch's secretary, Patriarch Elias advised his community members not to develop close relations with Armenians and not to get involved in their movements, not even in their cultural activities, such as music, which were then perceived as a symbol of national awakening. Keep our movements which trespass on Ottoman sensitivities, matters such as composing music. I see the Turkish state through the officials with whom I am in contact. They regard the Armenians with extreme caution, and that through a finely focused microscope. Being aware of the fact that the new Turkish rulers required loyalty from the Assyrians, their Syriac Orthodox Church leadership warned them not to be involved in anything that could be interpreted as disloyalty towards Turkey. Socio-politically, there was thus no incentive for writing or publishing eyewitness accounts. As mentioned, this was already being hindered by the Turkish authorities, and would be considered an act of disloyalty towards the Turkish state and nation. Ishak Amale, a Syriac Catholic priest, was one of the few exceptions. While living in Lebanon in 1919, he published his eyewitness account anonymously in Arabic under the pseudonym of the Eyewitness. In his book, The Maduto di Soroy, Abraham Gabriel Sawami, one of the Sipho orphans in the Assyrian orphanage in Adana in Turkey, mentions another case from the early 1920s pertaining to attempts made by the religious leadership of the Syriac Orthodox Church to keep its members quiet about the Sipho and the rights of their people in the post-Sipho Turkey. The monk Yohanan Dolabani was given orders by his religious superiors, i.e. the Patriarch Elias, to keep quiet and stop writing patriotic poems and songs. They were afraid of Muslim reprisals and revenge if the Assyrians continued to raise their voice for national rights in the Assyrian areas. This was confirmed by the later Archbishop Julius Y. Cicek. Yohanan Dolabani was a monk at the Zarafan Monastery in Mardin during the war years, and later Archbishop of Mardin, who personally witnessed the atrocities. Nevertheless, although he published more than 70 books in Syriac, Arabic, and Turkish, he did not write anything about the Sipho. He even remained silent in his own biography, a place where one would expect to find personal reflections about daily life. There may be manuscripts and notes that he did not write, that he did write, that have remained behind closed doors in Turkey, where the denialist state policy continues. In 2005, Archbishop Athanasius Aprem Barsoem of Beirut mentioned to me that he had written an article in the Lebanese newspaper about the Sipho, where it had been asked by Patriarch Zaka to stop publishing material on the Sipho, because the Turkish authorities requested this of him, through the Syrian government. After informing me of this, he looked sad, but seemed to have accepted the situation, considering the position he was in. Recently, his cousin stated that after the publication of the newspaper article, the Archbishop was no longer allowed to travel to Turkey. There are several other reasons for the eyewitness accounts about the Sipho in Turkey, with a few exceptions. The intellectual body of the Assyrians was wiped out during the genocide. With those who were killed, a culture and way of life disappeared. Certain invaluable knowledge about the people vanished, and memories were lost. Most of the educated elites, who were often the clergy, were killed, and the fact that the majority of Assyrians living in rural areas were illiterate made it even harder to obtain written eyewitness accounts. If any accounts were written down, inevitably some must have been destroyed or lost during and after the genocide. This high illiteracy among the victim group, however, contributed to the phenomenon of oral transmission of storytelling. One reason why literate survivors who could write chose not to write was because they did not prioritize writing about what they had witnessed, because their focus was on their daily survival in a state of crisis. In his introduction, for instance, Karabashi notes that his accounts may look unorganized because they are not written chronologically. He then explains this is because the accounts are from the same time as when the sword of tyrants were pulled from their sheaves and shed blood without mercy. This is how every village and town became in deep grief, and every house became a house of grief. As previously mentioned, another reason for the silence about the Sipho in and outside the Turkish public sphere is that in the first decades after the Sipho, the Assyrians did not have a strong organized diaspora like the Armenians that could raise their issue to a political agenda, an international political agenda. The tale, the agony of the Christians in the Middle East does not end here. In fact, it continues and worsens. But I do not feel that this format is sufficient to be able to explain the implications of the continued persecution of Christians in the recent decades until modern day. Instead, I would like to leave this to the format afforded by The History of Today, my series with Semiagog. We're finishing off this topic on the agony of Middle Eastern Christendom, a history of persecution. I want to refer back to a poem. This is a poem written by Gallo Sharbo, the leader who had forced back the Kurds and the Turks in the defense of Awado. The inhabitants of this village, together with the refugees from other villages, managed to successfully defend themselves against the Turkish soldiers and the Kurds, of course, as previously stated. After Gallo Sharbo fled to Iraq, he wrote a long poem, essentially serving as an eyewitness to what he had experienced during the war. In this poem, he laments what had happened to his people and why he thinks it happened. The explanations of Gallo Sharbo are multidimensional and assume both an innerworldly and a religious discourse. When he relates historical facts and his sources for such, like the political situation in relation to different groups who were involved in the war, he remains in the innerworldly discourse. But when he tells about the most difficult time of the battle during their defence in Awado, he enters a religious dimension. Because of our iniquity, the walls that surrounded us were breached. Our Lord's mercy, which protects us, he distanced from us. Believe, O my brothers, that our wrongdoing is greater than any other. For God forbid the Muslims to chastise us, except if it be rightly so.